welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. My guest today is Peace Ajo Mudia, the author of the debut novel, His Only Wife. I loved this novel that deals with women living in a patriarchal society in Ghana and told through the eyes of a woman who is in an arranged marriage. And I loved that Peace was able to tell a story with such a powerful message in such a propulsive, readable way. Peace is a senior lecturer in gender and international politics at the University of Bristol and a research fellow at the University of Ghana. Her short stories have been published in Transition, Slice, Four Way Review, and elsewhere. She is also the author of Global Norms and Local Action, The Campaigns to End Violence Against Women in Africa. She holds a PhD in Public and International Affairs from the University of Pittsburgh and a BA in Geography from the University of Ghana. And she was born in Liberia. Welcome, Peace.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to talk to you. I absolutely loved your book, as I mentioned earlier. I read it this summer and actually read it on vacation. And for a book that deals with very serious topics, it actually was a great vacation read as well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
And for those listeners who have not yet read your book, can you tell us a little bit about it?
His Only Wife is a story about Afi. Afi is a young woman in Ghana who finds herself in an arranged marriage to Eli. Eli is a wealthy man. And this is a marriage that has been arranged by Ellie's mother, Auntie. And she's arranged this marriage because she disapproves of Ellie's partner. So Afi is this young woman who has been selected by Ellie's mother to basically bring him closer to his family. And so what we get to see in the book is how Afi navigates this very difficult relationship where she's under pressure from many sides to be a good wife, to make her family happy, to make his family happy. And so we get to see her grow and find her voice in this very difficult setting.
And you have been studying and writing about and teaching gender politics up until this point. How did you decide to look at these issues through the lens of fiction?
So my research focuses mainly on gender and on women. And it's just because I'm just very interested in understanding the challenges that women face and how we can overcome these challenges. And so when I was doing my PhD, I focused on gender and conflict, specifically how post-conflict states deal with violence against women. Well, during and after my PhD, I did field work in Liberia and in Cote d'Ivoire, studying how the countries were dealing with violence against women, specifically how the police dealt with women who, or assisted women who came to the police station seeking help. And I spoke to a range of people, including survivors of violence, including intimate partner violence. And one of the things that I found in the interviews that I did was that a lot of women were staying in relationships in which they were unhappy, in which they experienced abuse because of pressure from relatives and friends. So I spoke to women who wanted to leave violent relationships, and they would say, well, you know, my mother said, you know, what are people going to say? And my friend said, you know, who is going to take care of the kids if you leave this man? And that is why I stayed. And I mean, this got me thinking, and this is not to blame women for staying in abusive relationships. It's a very, very difficult decision. But it really got me thinking about the pressures that we face as women, you know, different kinds of social pressures. How do we deal with these pressures? And so I wanted to write about this, but at the same time, I did not want to write about violence. because by this point, I've been studying violence for years, and it was just all I wrote about, all I read about, what I taught about. Most of my professional discussions were about violence, and I just wanted to take a step back from all of that talk about violence and thinking about violence. But at the same time, I wanted to explore these very difficult issues in a way that was easily readable, digestible. I thought about also my students, because I do use some of my short fiction to teach. And I noticed that my students really connected with the material in ways that they didn't connect with academic journal articles, for example.
Absolutely.
So in addition to exploring these really challenging issues, but without talking about violence, I also wanted to write in a way that my students could read and in a way that I could illustrate all of the academic, the theories and themes that I discuss in the classroom without it sounding academic. So those were the kind of the two things that I was thinking about when I began writing the book.
And I think Afi is a character that I know I really connected with. And I think that, you know, her situation obviously is probably more extreme than some people's, but many different marriages probably have kernels, at least, of what Afi was dealing with in them and make her very relatable to lots of people.
I very much agree. And as I was writing, I could see how people would connect with the character. Because whilst, you know, one might not be facing an arranged marriage,
right,
we all often find ourselves in situations where, or relationships where you have all of these challenges and you face all of these difficulties. And if you step back from, you know, the story about an arranged marriage, it's really a story about a person just trying to find her way in this world and to find her voice and to speak up for what she believes in. And I think that that is something that a lot of us can relate to.
Certainly. And let's talk a little bit about arranged marriage. There was one quote in particular that struck me in your book, and it was, everyone had to get something out of this union. Very simple, but really, I thought, encapsulated a lot of what Afi was going through, and even her own family members were putting so much pressure on her. I remember her uncle in particular just wanted lots of material things from her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit about this practice, how it happens in real life? How common is it? How does it usually play out?
So arranged marriages do happen, but I don't think they are common. And I say that because I don't know of anyone in my generation or even my parents' generation who has an arranged marriage. So this is not to say that it doesn't happen. What tends to be the case is that you might find it more in some communities than others. Within my community and within many of the communities in which I know people, in which I speak with people, this is not something that is common. And so in writing this, I think I was drawing a lot on things I had read, a lot of it historical as well, but also experiences from other places apart from Ghana. But at the same time, that made writing this fun because I wasn't necessarily drawing on anybody's life story.
Right.
I was just imagining, you know, how would this happen and how would a young woman deal with it and how would she feel about it?
Sure. Where is it more common?
I'm not sure where arranged marriages are more common, whether within Ghana or outside of Ghana, but I think it's likely to be more common in very traditional societies.
Right.
And I think arranged marriages are, and I mean, if you think about them as they happened even historically in places like Europe, arranged marriages tend to be between families.
Yep.
And a lot of it is also about whether it's keeping wealth within families, whether it's protecting resources in some way. It's tied a lot to resources and people wanting to, for example, ensure that they maintain their class status or to ensure that they maintain linkages between families. So I think communities where these things still matter communities in which you are more likely to have arranged marriages.
Which is interesting because that's different than sort of the driving force behind Afi's marriage in his only wife. That was more wanting to separate Ellie from Muna.
Yes, it is. It is. I did think about what is the most drastic thing that a mother-in-law would do if she doesn't she doesn't like the woman her son is with. And I think that was like one of the the most extreme things I could come up with that a mother-in-law would do. And I would not be surprised that someone would have a story somewhere of a mother-in-law doing this.
So let's talk a little bit about the patriarchal society. And interestingly, this literally just occurred to me right this second as we were talking about Auntie, that it is such a patriarchal society. And Ellie is, you know, everyone's supposed to bow down to Ellie and make sure he has what he needs. But also Auntie has so much control.
Mm-hmm.
As well, who is, for y'all, if you haven't read the book yet, Auntie is Ellie's mother. So Afi's mother-in-law.
Well, yeah. So, and I think you've captured it very well that, yes, it is a society that is male-dominated, or at least a society in which men are trying to dominate. But Ghana is also a society in which women have always had a voice, in which women have always been important players socially. I mean, economically, I would say women are the backbone of the informal economy in Ghana, even politically. And when we talk about Ghana's political past and current, women often are not at the forefront. But when you do research, and I am writing a book about this because I'm so passionate about this.
Right.
When you do research, you find that from, you know, before colonization and during colonization and after colonization, women were so important in pushing for change. Women were a key part of the anti-colonization movement, the pro-independence movement in Ghana. Yet their story often doesn't get told. So all of this to say that, yes, there are definitely a lot of men and to an extent a lot of women who have been working actively to protect male domination. But then there have also been a lot of women who have always pushed back and pushed back in ways big and small. And to me, this is very important because also when we think about women who push back against patriarchy, against male domination, we often think about women who have done very heroic things, and that's fine. But I'm also very interested in the day-to-day things that people do to assert themselves, to make a way for themselves. And sometimes it's simply saying, no, I won't do this. Or simply you know, feeling brave enough to voice your opinion that goes against the status quo. So yes, patriarchy has always been an issue, but at the same time, it's a society in which women have done a lot to advance themselves and to fight for equality.
Right. And you mentioned women pushing back in ways both big and small. And I think in the book, we have women pushing back in their own lives and then kind of viewed as, and I'm particularly thinking of Muna, how she's viewed as this just difficult, disrespectful woman because she's not willing to toe the line from Ellie's family and his mom.
Yes, yes. And I think Muna and even Evelyn, so Evelyn's another character who is seen as disrespectful, they are very much playing an important role in that just by saying, I disagree, they are seen as people who are troublemakers and people who should be pushed away. But like I said, they are playing an important role because, among other things, I think they show the importance of dissenting voices within the story, but within life. And I'm glad that you used the term disrespectful because I have been thinking about them as disrespectful women in that Ghana is a society in which too many people use the word respect to kind of keep women in what they think is like a woman's place. And so it's very common that if a woman is seen as too assertive, if, you know, she speaks her mind, if she just goes against the status quo in any way, it's, you know, it's disrespectful. And I think respect is so important in society, but what we have is respect being twisted in such a way that any woman, especially young women who try to stand up for themselves, are viewed as disrespectful. And then you have this pressure on young women to respect men, right? So there's always, you have to respect men. And also, you, I find that too many young men live in fear of this, and I'm using air quotes, so you can't see me. But you have all these young men who are just afraid of being disrespected by young women or by women more broadly. And what is disrespect? It is a woman saying, no, I don't want to do this. No, you know, I want to go to school. No, I want to pursue my career. No, I want to go out and come home late and party with my friends. And to them, that is respect. And I mean, this is not like across the board. There are a lot of people, including men in Ghana, who don't agree with these ideas and these norms, but it's quite common, right? And so you then have all these young men who are so invested. And as we see in the book, even women who are invested in ensuring that women are not disrespectful, that women are, in their terms, respectful and do as they are told. And to me, that is extremely problematic, because it is this idea that women need to respect that explains a lot of things, including violence. Because, you know, the idea that you have to submit, and if you don't submit, you are hit and you deserve it because you were disrespectful. So these are all the things that contribute towards violence and to also a lot of inequalities in society. And it's not only a Ghanaian story. It's a global story. We see it across the world in many societies. So I think it's extremely important for women to be disrespectful. And even if you think about it outside of the home, right? Ghana, like America, has never had a female president. And we have to ask ourselves why. Why is it that women are brilliant, women are capable, women are hardworking. Why is it that they have not advanced to this highest office in the land, right? But if you look at the research that has been done on women in politics in Ghana, and it's quite similar to what you see about women in politics in the U.S. and in many other places, female politicians face so much abuse.
Absolutely.
Female politicians are judged in ways that male politicians are not. People comment on their appearances, on their private life. And I mean, those are things that, you know, male politicians don't have to deal with. And so when you think about it, a woman who has to advance in politics has to be disrespectful, right? She has to say, I don't care what you think, this is what I'm going to do.
And when a man does that, they're viewed as strong.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And when a woman does that, they're viewed as dislikable.
Exactly. Exactly. So I really wanted to write about women who were being disrespectful, and disrespectful in all kinds of ways. And I mean, my hope is that we should just see these narratives so much that it becomes normal, that this so-called disrespect, which really isn't disrespect, it's just women standing up for themselves, that it becomes normalized. And that, you know, young women, girls are going to read such books and be like, okay, well, you know, I too can say no and not have to worry about being seen as someone who's not good and someone who is not deserving.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that a fee doesn't just come into the marriage immediately thinking, oh, I'm going to blaze my own trail. She does in the sense where she's going to pursue a career in design, but she also really tries hard to be what she thinks in her mind is, you know, quote, a good wife to Ellie, which I was actually surprised about. I didn't expect that. And I thought it added a lot of sort of internal conflict with her that just added such depth to the story.
Yeah, I wanted the story to be realistic.
Yeah.
But a lot of the things that Afi did, I wouldn't do, but it's because I'm not Afi.
Right.
We have very different social, economic backgrounds. But at the same time, when I was writing, I kept thinking, what would someone in this situation do? A young woman from a poor family who aspires to so much but cannot get as far as she wants to because of, you know, social and economic restrictions, right? So I wanted to write a story that will reflect what someone in that situation would do. And this is not to say every poor young woman would agree to an arranged marriage and would try to follow the rules. But I felt that there's a good chance that a woman in that situation who is not only in a very difficult socioeconomic position, but is also under so much pressure, will try to conform and will try to follow the rules and do the things that she's been told to do.
It rang true, for sure.
I'm glad it did. I really wanted it to be. And it's very tempting that as a feminist writing, it's very tempting for you to try to impose your own ideas on the character and for the character to do things the way you would do things. And for me, it was very important that Afi not behave like I would behave.
So this leads me to the question, out of sort of the three central women, Afi, Muna, and Evelyn, do you see yourself as more like one than the others?
That's a good question. Okay, I think what I would say is that there's definitely a character that I aspire to, that I want to be like, and that is Evelyn. In my dreams, I want to be a woman who just does not care.
Don't we all?
Just does not care about what people say or what people think and just lives life fully.
Yep.
Right. And of course, I don't think we can live in this world and absolutely not care about anything or anyone. I think that in itself will be problematic. But to not be so bogged down and have yourself tied up because you're just worried about people, often people who should not matter. So I think of the three, Evelyn is the character that I would most love to be like.
I enjoyed Evelyn too. She just kind of, and for y'all that haven't read the book yet, she is sort of dating Ellie's brother, kind of, but kind of hidden on the side. But she kind of does her own thing and lives her life and sees Richard, the brother, when she feels like it and doesn't get too emotionally invested in it and takes the good, but kind of preserves herself through it all.
Yes. And I absolutely love her for that. I do feel bad. Sometimes I think she's my favorite character and I feel guilty. I'm like, Afi should be your favorite character, not Evelyn. I'm struggling with that part.
So let's talk about Muna for a minute, because I felt like she was such a huge part of the story, but she lived a little bit off the page. We heard so much about her from other characters, but never really directly from her. So did you ever consider sort of writing portions of the book from her perspective? And what might that have been? Like, what might her general sort of views on things been?
I definitely considered, but then decided not to, because I wanted to center Afi in this story.
Sure.
But also I wanted us, and if you... I'm sure you noticed that we learn about Muna just as Afi learns about Muna. And for me, that was very important.
Yes.
That we were seeing things through Afi's eyes. And in order for us to see things through Afi's eyes, I felt like Muna had to be a bit hidden in the background and for us to gradually discover what was going on. But also, I think something else that influenced the way I wrote the book was that regardless of what Muna was thinking or what was driving her, at the end of the day, what mattered is what Afi saw and what Afi experienced, because those were the things that Afi was reacting to. So even if we knew Muna's background and why she was in this relationship, what wouldn't change was that she was reacting in a certain way, and Afi, who is the center of this universe, was then experiencing her in a certain way. So that is why I decided to just center Afi, because regardless of what was happening behind the scenes with Muna, Afi's experiences were going to be the same. But I think in many ways, I thought of Muna as a character who was similar to Evelyn.
Yes.
And if I had written her story, I mean, there are parts where Evelyn actually seems to admire her. And I think it's because they have a lot in common. But if I had written Mona's story, she would have very much been like Evelyn, a woman who knows what she wants, is not concerned about pleasing people, wants to be happy, and basically wants to have the life that she's imagined for herself and is willing to upset people to have that life.
Absolutely. And let's talk about that ending a little bit without talking about what it actually is, if we can do this.
Yes.
When I first read the ending, I remember being surprised. And then before we were going to record, I reread the last chapter or so and really just came to love how it wrapped up. I love the different perspective you get on Muna at the end. I guess my question would be, how did you decide what the ending would be without actually saying what it is? And did you always know how it would end, or did that sort of come to you as you were writing these characters?
Well, so I did not. Well, okay, take a step back. I thought I knew how it would end, but then as I wrote the book, the ending changed.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes. And that happens quite a bit with my writing. I write out entire stories in my head before I ever put something down on paper or type anything. I spend months and sometimes years just thinking about characters and their stories. So I thought I knew what Afi was going to do. But then I began writing. And when I write, things that I did not initially think about somehow filter or creep into the story. But then the characters also just start to grow and take on a life of their own, take on a mind of their own, and begin to then follow paths that I didn't initially plot for them. And for that reason, I embraced that, first of all. And I let the characters do what they want, because I think that makes it more authentic, in that, once again, I'm not imposing my views and my ideas and expectations on the character, but I'm letting the character do what comes naturally. So basically, as the character of Afi developed, there were things that I had initially thought she would do that didn't make sense. Like, they seemed out of character for her.
Can you share something you thought she would do that ended up not making sense and then didn't make it in the book?
Oh, wow. Well, a lot of that is tied too closely.
Okay, too spoilery.
To the ending, yes.
Okay, let's not go there. I definitely do not want to spoil anything on the show.
Yeah, I said the ending, I've spoken to people who are like, I wanted a different ending. And I can see why they wanted a different ending.
That's how I first felt. But when I read it again, I was like, no, I like this ending. I like it.
Well, yeah. So I think after all that Afi had gone through, this was just the natural progression and the natural ending place for her.
Right.
Yes. So this was just a case of the character, I would say, taking a hold of the story. And, you know, just doing what they want. And that's one of the best parts about writing. And that is why I started writing. I should say I began writing when I was about 10. Well, I didn't have a computer. I guess computers existed back then, but I didn't have one. But I really would just take a paper and then say, I'm going to write a story. And would not know what I was going to write, but I would start writing. And the fun part about it was that things would just begin to happen on the page. And I love that almost as much as I love reading.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I absolutely love writing.
That's a big statement.
Well, yeah. So, okay. I think going back again to talk about how I began writing because I ran out of books to read.
Oh, interesting.
I was such a voracious reader as a child. Like, I read everything in my school's library, everything in the public library. I would go to people's houses and borrow books, adults. So I read so many adult books, including books that are very inappropriate for children. I would just read everything. And when I ran out of books and like new books were not being bought quickly enough, I decided to write my own books for myself. And I had this entire system where I would come back from school and pretend to be doing schoolwork, but I'd actually be writing stories. I'll write my stories and then I'll set them aside for days and sometimes weeks. And this setting aside of my stories was so that I would get some distance from them And then when I came back to read them, it would seem as if someone else had written them. Because I wasn't interested in being a writer. I was interested in reading books that were written by other people. But because I didn't have enough of those books, I would write my own stories and try to believe that someone else had written them.
That is the best story. I love that.
Well, yeah. So, but then as I began to write, I realized that I loved it almost as much as I loved reading, just because just how when you read a book, you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. I would write and not really know what the characters were going to do. I mean, I've become more disciplined now where I actually try to plot things out and outline things, even if the stories don't always go the way I planned. But when I started, I would just like grab a pen and paper and be like, I'm writing a story about a woman. And then, I don't know, I would just start writing and the story would appear on the page. I'm not entirely sure how it happened, but that is what used to happen.
Do you remember the first story you wrote?
I have no idea.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, but what I remember was that I tried to write exactly the kind of stories I was reading. So even though I had never left Liberia or Ghana, because I spent part of my childhood in Liberia, all of the books I read were set in America, in the US or in Europe.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and that was because all of the children's books that I read were set in Europe and in America. So all of my characters were like used to ski, even though I'd never seen snow before. And they ate plums, even though I didn't know what a plum was. Because my focus was really not on being a writer. My focus was on recreating exactly what I was reading.
What you'd seen already.
Yes.
Wow.
So that I can just read it and enjoy it some more.
Oh my gosh. That is, well, I'm really glad you did that as a kid, because now you're here and we get to read your books. So, and speaking of, I know, you know, you're sort of, I don't want to say day job, but what is in academia. Do you think you'll write another novel? What's next for you?
Oh, yes. I have written another novel.
Oh, yay. Can you tell us anything about it?
Yes, it is a novel about friendship. I'm very interested in friendships and in how they evolve over time. This novel follows two cousins who were very close in childhood, but then as time goes by, they kind of split apart. I mean, they were like twins, and over time, they almost hate each other. And what I do in the book is explore why this change has happened. And key to this is about how we experience or how we think about truth, and how two people can have very similar experiences but interpret it very differently. So you have these two young women who, because of a series of things that happened, have been separated, and both of them think about it very differently, and both feel aggrieved. And both feel like the other is wrong. And what I do in this book is follow them from childhood into when they are mothers, so into adulthood, and try to make sense of why this division happened. And, you know, kind of, yeah, explore how relationships change over time.
This sounds amazing. I can't wait to read it. Has it gone through the official process yet? Does it have a publication date? Where are we with this?
No, not yet. I'm currently editing, but okay. hopefully I'll have more news soon.
Oh, good. Well, I will keep an eagle eye out for that for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Let's get to your book recommendations. As always, Peace is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she does not love, and one upcoming release she's excited about. Tell me about the first old book you love.
So it's Nervous Conditions by Titi Dangaremba, who is a Zimbabwean author, and who, by the way, has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
I saw that.
Yes, yes. And I mean, she's just an amazing writer. So this is a story about a young girl, Tambu, who is growing up in a poor family and is very much expected to put aside her dreams to support the men in her family. And it's the story of how she tries to get to where she wants to be in life. in a story about how she pushes back and asserts herself. And I just absolutely love this story. I absolutely love the voice of Tambu. And I mean, this is I first read this book years ago, and it's just one of the stories that has stuck with me over so many years.
And this came out in 1988. And is this considered sort of a modern classic of African literature?
Yeah, I would say even beyond Africa, it's very widely read. It's very widely read. And Titi has published several books after this, but this remains my favorite.
And the sequel to this, that's what was nominated for the Booker.
Yes.
Did you read that too?
I have not read that, just because I read some reviews that led me to believe that Tambu would have a difficult life.
Oh.
I just love the character so much. And I said, I cannot bear to see her suffer. So I'm like the ostrich who has buried her head. And I said, I will pretend like this first part is where, you know, Tambu's story ends, because I don't want to read a story in which she suffers. I mean, she did suffer a bit, well, quite a bit in the first novel. But still, I mean, this is a character that I love so much that my heart would just be broken to read about her suffering.
Oh.
I don't know, maybe I will reach a point where I can read the sequel. I definitely would. It's such an amazing book. But now I'm too fragile and too much not willing to read stories that break my heart.
Fair enough. And this book sounds like it deals with a lot of the themes we talked about earlier as well.
Yes. Yes, it does.
All right. That was Nervous Conditions by Tsitsi Dangarembga. Tell me about the second old book you love.
So it's Tanya James's Aerograms and Other Stories. And this is a collection of short stories. And I was trying to think about whether it's my favorite. Another collection that I love is The Thing Around Your Neck by Chimamanda Adichie. And I was torn. But I absolutely love Aerograms and Other Stories. And it contains a host of very eclectic characters, including my favorite Indian wrestlers in Edwardian England. The story is called The Lion and Panther in London. And it's told through the eyes of two Indian wrestlers. But what it also is a commentary on British Empire and British imperialism. And apart from, the characters that just really draw you in, Tanya James's writing is so very beautiful. Her descriptions are so artful. And she just really makes the stories come alive. And I read this many, many years ago, but it's still one of, I think, the best short story collections that I've read.
Are you a big short story reader in general?
I think I go through phases. So a few years ago, I was reading a lot of short stories. And when I say a few, I mean like between 2012 and about 2015, I read a lot of short stories. But that was also a time when I was also writing a lot of short stories.
Right.
I don't read as many short stories as I used to.
Fair. I feel like I'm the same. I never read a lot of short stories, but I used to read more than I have recently. And I don't know why that is. It was not intentional.
Is that one that you've read recently that you've loved?
Oh, I got it. I actually don't think I've read a single short story collection in 2020. But looking back, the last one that I loved was Curtis Sittenfeld's You Think It, I'll Say It. And I can't remember. Maybe it was that 2018, maybe.
Okay.
The year that came out.
Okay. Well, I haven't read it. I will take note of that.
I did remember, and I haven't read this book either, but I remember a couple years ago when Tanya James's The Tusk That Did the Damage came out, the book about the elephants.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember kind of being interested in reading that and not getting to it. But that sounded like an interesting story as well.
Yeah.
All right. That was Aerograms and Other Stories by Tanya James. And tell me about the first new book you love.
So the first new book I love is Wyatt Moore's The Dragon, The Giant, The Woman. It's a memoir. And I should start by saying that I love this story, not only because the writing is brilliant and the story is moving, but also because I was born in Liberia and I lived in Liberia during the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
For parts of the Civil War. And I do teach about wars and teach about conflict. And I think that when it comes to wars in Africa, we often don't center women's voices, not as sources of knowledge anyway. We rarely teach the material written by African women. And we just, I guess, also just don't see a lot of people who have experienced conflict, women who have experienced conflict firsthand writing about it. And so I'm just, as a scholar, as a teacher, I'm just so very excited to see this book. And I think that in addition to just reading it, that it should probably be on syllabi. If you're teaching about gender, if you're teaching about politics, it should be. But also if you're teaching about the immigrant experience, I think it's a great book to put on your syllabi. But it tells the story of Waiatu Moore's like families, their escape from Liberia during the Civil War, and I mean how they made it across the border and how they eventually came to America, and how, you know, she's also experienced life in America, and which among other things has included the experience of racism. It's a very powerful story. And I'm just so happy to see such a wonderful book written about Liberia.
I've heard this book has a somewhat of an interesting structure to it. Is that the case?
It does, in that she does travel across time, across countries in the way that I found to be just very, very gripping, in a way that really beautifully communicates what happens. So, yeah, it's just, I love this book.
Have you ever heard of The Girl Who Smiled Beads?
I have heard about it. I haven't read it.
So when I was reading about this book, it sounded so similar to me. Different country and different conflict, but also the story of escaping. This was the Rwandan genocide.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and on foot, and it's told through the eyes of a young girl, like a child. And her very long journey as a refugee, finally ending up in the United States. And it was heartbreaking and so good.
Oh, okay. I have not read it. I'm noting that down as well. I have this very long to be read
list.
Oh,
yes.
And I keep adding.
Don't we all? Yeah, I just kept thinking about that book that I had read when I was reading about The Dragons, the Giant, and Women.
Yeah, it's good to know.
All right, so that was The Dragons, the Giant, and Women by Waiatu Moore. And tell me about the second new book you love.
So the second book is Shruti Swami's A House is a Body, and it's also a collection of short stories. And I read this book very recently. Shruti and I did it's not an interview. We did an event where we discussed our books, because her book was also recently published. And so I think that is how I came to read it. And I just really, really enjoyed this book. I mean, it's a collection of short stories dealing with issues such as love and loss and grief. And I remember as I was reading it, thinking that it's like grief is almost a character in the book. And I just really, really loved that part about it. And then also just reading it, I was physically impacted by the book in ways that I'm still trying to understand. But like parts of it seem almost magical in the way that it's written, but also because she writes about things that are almost magical. But it's almost as if I was carried away by some of the stories. And one of my favorite is Earthly Pleasures, and it's about a god living on earth. And I was reading it and thinking, I mean, it just, she writes so well that you're able to suspend belief. And like, yeah, totally, that makes sense. Krishna could totally be living among us as a person. So yeah, I enjoyed it. Like I said, I don't read short stories as much as I used to.
Right.
But I'm really, really glad that I read this one.
And she has a novel coming out, I saw, too.
Oh, okay. I think I heard she has a novel coming out.
I don't know when. It's called The Archer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's not even on Goodreads yet.
Oh.
I saw when I was reading about A House as a Body, I saw that she does have a novel coming up. And that would be her debut novel.
I'm sure it will just be incredible based on what I've seen of her short stories.
That is A House as a Body by Shruti Swami, and that came out in August, so just out. All right, let's talk about the book you did not love. So many people, by the way, answer this question with classics, which always makes me laugh because I have trouble with the classics. I am kind of allergic to them.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The way I think about it is that even what we consider classic is very much about whose stories we've allowed.
Yep.
Or whose stories have been at the center of literature for a while. for centuries. And I mean, there are just so many amazing books written by African scholars that are not considered classics.
Absolutely.
Right. And absolutely should be classics. So for me, even the whole idea of classics is something that I don't know, we could unpack that. That's another conversation.
Yes.
So I have here War and Peace. And I should say the main thing is I found it too dense and I didn't make it far.
How far did you make it?
I think I don't know if I went past like the first 20 pages.
I mean, I haven't even attempted it. I know that this is not the book for me without having to attempt it.
Well, and I should say this was a long time ago. And who knows? And this, once again, this was me being young and just like reading everything that I came across.
Sure.
There's just so many books that I read as a kid and as a teenager that I didn't fully understand or grasp. And I probably should read them all over again. So yes, this was a long time ago and I might just give it another go.
Oh, let me know how it goes if you do that.
If I get to it, I will let you know.
If you can find the time to fit in a 1400 page behemoth of a novel.
Yes.
So that was War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And the upcoming release that you're going to share, I am excited for this one as well. I actually have The Galley. So when you mentioned it, I went and peeked. Yes, I went and peeked at the beginning of it. And it has a pretty magical first paragraph.
I am so jealous right now. I'm so jealous. So it's Liberté by Caitlin Greenridge. And I only heard about this book yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I saw the cover is so beautiful. And the cover reveal was yesterday. And I thought, oh my goodness, what is this book about? And it's about a young woman in the 1800s living in New York and like spanning her life in New York and in Haiti. And it's very much about a woman trying or pushing back against the expectations that she subordinate herself to men. And a woman standing up for herself. And it's very much my kind of story based on the summary that I saw.
Yes. And it's based on the life of a real person, right?
Yes, I heard that.
From what I read, it's based on the life of the first Black female doctor in New York State in the time of Reconstruction. So a long time ago. And this sounds so fascinating to me. And I loved her writing. I had not read her previous book, We Love You, Charlie Freeman. But so when I just peeked at the beginning and peeked at her writing, I really, really liked it and very excited to dig in a little bit closer to publication date.
Oh my goodness. No, I'm more excited than I was yesterday.
Oh, good. And it's coming out March 30th, 2021, y'all. That is Liberté by Caitlin Greenidge.
Yes.
All right. I love to close out every episode with asking my guest what the last 5-star book you read was.
It is Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. And I'm still reading it, actually.
And you know it's going to be 5 stars already. I love it.
Okay. I think I've used the word beautiful too many times. It's a beautiful book. It just does such an excellent job of bringing the Black British experience to life. And Black women are portrayed so fully and with so much love on the page. And I think that's not something we see enough of. And for that reason, but also because of just how beautiful the writing is, how it draws you in. I think it's an excellent book. It's a 5-star book. And I'm sure everybody who's read it, or most people who've read it, would agree.
Thank you so much, Peace. I have loved talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. This being such a fun conversation.
All right, y'all. The October Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Peace's picks for categories like favorite book set in Ghana other than her own, and favorite creepy book, since this episode is airing just a few days before Halloween. And if you would like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. There is a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. And remember, we are on our bi-weekly airing schedule, so no new episode next week. But in 2 weeks, which is November 11th, I will be talking all things audiobooks with Claire Hanscom of Libro FM. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.